Oh, shut up, George. You can't work, so I can hear you, George. You can whisper.
Okay, very good. This is, according to my watch, Saturday the 13th of August, to quote Pogo, Friday the 13th comes on a Saturday this month. And I'm George Dole, and the theme is families in the Bible, and my title is Family Devalues in the Gospels. The matter of family values has been front and center in recent years, especially among those who've come to be known as the Christian right. Now, I don't doubt for a moment that the family is an institution of vital importance. I know that my own family of origin had a great deal to do with my becoming the person I am. I know that my relationships with my wife and our children are so central to me that I have no idea who on earth I'd be without them. But as far as the explicitly Christian connection is concerned, it's a striking fact that the word family is found only once or twice in, depending on which translation you use, in the New Testament. One occurrence is in Ephesians 3:15, which reads, "For that reason I bend the knee to the Father, from whom every family in the heavens and on earth takes its name." That doesn't say very much about family values. That's the human family. Very much like the Lord's command not to call anyone on earth Father, because our only true Father is God. And that, again, is hardly a ringing endorsement of what we think of as the nuclear family. The other instance is in the Gospel of Mark, and I'll get to it later. There are some references to family relationships in the Gospels, though. And it turns out that many of them, the majority, sound a very similar note. So let me save those for a moment and deal with the exceptions. The commandment to honor father and mother is endorsed in both Matthew and Mark. In Luke 11, there's note taken of the fact that parents do know how to give good gifts to their children. And the parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15 sets the father's forgiving spirit as an image of divine forgiveness. There's one statement in John that Jesus went to Capernaum with his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and remained there a few days. Doesn't say how they got along. It winds up as a pretty neutral reference. And there is the statement from our scripture reading that Jesus at the age of 12 went back to Nazareth and was subject to his parents. And since marriage is basic to the family, we should probably include Matthew 19:6. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one put asunder. Well, Jesus' relationship with his parents was obviously an equivocal one. In the story of the miracle at Cana, he addresses her not as mother, but as woman, and says, "What do I have to do with you?" And then there is that story that we read at the age of 12. He said, "Why have you been looking for me? Didn't you realize I should be about my father's business," which is virtually a disavowal of his parents. Then on the cross, he commended his mother to the disciple John, which is a very caring act. Well, that just about takes care of the good news. Now let me run through the other references. I'm just going to string them all together for their cumulative effect. Another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me, let the dead bury their own dead." Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. "For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against his mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and your enemies will be the members of your own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave to his wife. That one's ambivalent. I tell you in truth, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for my sake and for the sake of the gospel, who will not receive 100-fold now in this age, houses, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, fields, with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life. Just note that it's hard to take literally a promise that one is going to receive mothers 100-fold. Someone told him, "Look, your mother and your brothers are standing outside waiting to speak to you." But Jesus replied to the one who had told him, "Who is my mother? Who are my brothers?" And pointing to his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea so that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one who wants to be known widely acts in secret. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. Then he went home, and the crowd came together again so that they could not even eat. When his family heard of it, there's the other occurrence of the word family. When his family heard of it, they went out to restrain him, for they said, "He's lost his mind." There are the family values of the Gospels. There's really no way, honest way to escape the fact that they receive very little explicit attention in the books that are the foundation of Christianity, and that where there is a direct reference to family relationships, they're pictured as obstacles to true religious devotion, and that the family seems to be more a liability than an asset. And I think there's a fairly cogent literal validity to this, and I'm going to spend most of the time, I think probably all if I remember correctly, on basically the literal sense. We need only to look at what is currently referred to as the dysfunctional family to be reminded that family relationships can be immensely destructive. And it can be a catch-22 situation. The members of the family depend on the family in different ways. So that even when there are serious problems, it can be very difficult to stand against it or to leave it. And this is obviously true of the abused wife. It's no less true of the abused husband, certainly true of children. The energy behind an abusive husband's to maintain absolute control, the energy comes largely from the fear of being deserted. So in this and in any other number of destructive situations, there's all too often a kind of conspiracy of silence. So school teachers are now trained to look for signs of physical abuse in children because they know that the children themselves won't tell on their parents. And this has happened in Swedenborgian circles as well as others. Two very negative references to a compulsion to publicize the secrets of the home in marriage love have been taken to justify this. You must keep the secrets of the home. You mustn't tell people when bad things are happening in the home. Well, there's clearly a risk involved whenever internal problems are papered over rather than brought to the surface and dealt with. And in this instance, the risk seems particularly high with two of the reasons given in marriage love for maintaining appearances. There's a whole chapter on that. For the sake of reputation outside the home, in paragraph section 286, and for the sake of excusing faults and avoiding disgrace in section 288. These reasons can all too easily be used to justify this kind of conspiracy of silence and this evasion, this shameful evasion of accountability. But in fact, that section of marriage love starts with a safeguard against any such abuse. These marital pretenses, these apparent maintaining the appearance of marriage, are to exhibit a wisdom based on justice, judgment, and prudence. That's back in sections 280 and 281. That is, the pretenses are not just to be talked about. They're just not to be matters of not saying things. They are to be lived. Husbands and to wives are advised to behave properly toward each other, to follow the rules even though their hearts are not in it. The true apparent marriage, that is, that isn't a real marriage that is talked about in that book, is not just maintaining a public face to the world that looks good, but maintaining that behavior within the home. But again, this section and the denunciation of publishing the secrets of the home have been used to rationalize the sadly common practice of giving family loyalty, or some facsimile thereof, priority over a genuine concern for the well-being of the members of the family, for the health of the relationships within it. And it's a matter of priorities. It's not intrinsically wrong to love father or mother or son or daughter. No, not at all. The problem comes when this love is not in its proper relationship to love of the Lord. This is most clearly expressed in Matthew, whoever loves father or mother more than me, doesn't say whoever loves father and mother is not worthy of me. It says whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And it sounds heartless. It isn't at all. And we may perhaps put the matter in the form of a rough syllogism. The Lord is the incarnation of divine love, perfect, flawless love. So the Lord loves the father, the mother, the son, and the daughter the way they ought to be loved, the way they need to be loved. So if we put the love of the Lord first in our lives, we are also putting first the right kind, the best only possible right kind of love for father or mother or son or daughter. We're seeing our own children, our own spouses, our own parents in the light of our faith as first of all children of God. We're seeing ourselves as children of God primarily rather than first of all children of our parents. Seeing our children as children of God first of all rather than as our children. We need to let go of any tendency to possess them, to claim them, to claim ownership, to manipulate them to our own advantage. Another thing often involved here is family pride. I've come to think that the truly appropriate reaction of parents when their children turn out well isn't pride at all. Aren't you proud that your children are doing so well? I'm grateful. And there's a certain leaven of bewilderment in the gratitude. Yes, we as parents must have done something right. We really don't know exactly what it was. In all probability, many of the things that made the deepest impressions on our children are things we didn't even notice at the time. Things we did or said without really thinking. They may not have been the wonderful pearls of wisdom we imparted, but the things that the children noticed when we weren't even paying attention to them. I suspect that some of our cudgel your own memories for some of your fondest memories of your parents. I suspect many of them are moments like that, moments when our parents didn't feel as though they were under observation, weren't engaged in parenting, but were just unselfconsciously being their own dear selves. And family pride gets in the way of all such spontaneous, genuine moments of perception, because family pride involves constantly keeping score. Our team, you know the principle, our team plays good, hard-nosed football. They play dirty. Because we're right, because we're the good guys, the rules aren't really for us. The rules are for the bad guys, the other people. They shouldn't be allowed to interfere with our righteous agenda. The faults in our own family are understandable lapses. They're forgivable. While the faults in the family next door are not uncharacteristic lapses, are all their evidences of what they're really like under the surface, under all that facade. And it's not at all hard to see how the practice of maintaining appearances for the sake of reputation outside the home and for the sake of excusing faults and avoiding disgrace, could deteriorate from simple good judgment to outright dishonesty. Well, family pride starts early. One of Sir William Gilbert's more memorable characters, Pooh-Bah in the Mikado, carries it to its logical extreme. He is proud of his pride. And I quote, "I am, in point of fact," he says, "a particularly haughty and exclusive person of pre-Adamite ancestral descent. You will understand this when I tell you that I can trace my ancestry back to a protoplasmo-primordial atomic globule. Consequently, my family pride is something inconceivable. I can't help it. I was born sneering." Yeah. No, we aren't really born sneering, but parents can sneer for us, do all the sneering necessary. It's easy in a way because every newborn is a miracle. Computer simulations at one point were telling us that there was no way infants could learn everything they learn as fast as they do. The little critters are outright brilliant. And it sometimes seems as though the learning curve slows down as the years pass. Certainly there's evidence that children, say, learn new languages far more quickly and effectively than adults. But I want to digress a moment and say I don't think this is an accurate representation of what happens. I prefer to believe that everything we learn has to be integrated with everything we have learned. And that as the years come past, this process of integration becomes more and more complex and demanding. When a child learns, say, that the Nile River is the only river in the world that flows from south to north, that's a relatively isolated fact, simple, easy to grasp. But when adults hear this, it's likely to be associated with all kinds of images of Egypt, from the ancient pyramids and their mummies to the Aswan Dam and the political volatility of present times, and with the catalog of other rivers of the world, in our case, including the Saco. Which way does that flow? Well, all over the place. But be that as it may, family pride takes the fact that our newborn is brilliant to mean that our newborn is inherently superior to other newborns. And that's a message that the poor baby will take in with his mother's milk, so to speak. And some of the most formative influences parents exert on their children are the attitudes that are so constant that they're never verbalized and are therefore never challenged. And children will tend to take for granted the things that their parents take for granted, which is probably the principal reason that a child can be quite astonished to discover that other families have different unspoken assumptions. I had lunch with my friends down the street, and they didn't sit around the table, and they didn't say grace. Astonishing. So in a sense, we find ourselves faced with three possibilities. One is to maintain steadfastly that our family values and practices are absolutely right, that anyone who doesn't recognize this must be wrong and must be refuted, so that the way to defend our values is to trash the values of others. The second is complete relativism. Our family values are right for us, theirs are equally right for them. And the third is that there are standards by which different sets of family values can be evaluated. And that is simply, that's what the Gospels are telling us. It's what the Lord is telling the disciples in the discourse at the Last Supper when he enjoined them to love each other the way he had loved them. That's a very different way from the way many people, quote, love, close quote, each other. Some years ago, there was a documentary on battered women, and I can still see the bruised face of one woman and hear her saying, "But I love him." And I felt at the time and still feel today, I had no idea what she meant by that word, love. Was it feeling his joy as joy in herself, as DLW 47 would have it? How did it interact with the pain and the terror when she was being beaten, when the blows were being administered? Did it leave room for any sense of her own worth, her own understanding as a priceless child of God, any sense of her husband's as a child of God. So the word love doesn't answer these questions. It doesn't define itself. The fact that this is my mother or father or son or daughter or wife does not in and of itself tell me how I am to love these individuals. So if I put that relationship first, I'm flying blind. And when the Lord refers to himself as the way, I am the way, the truth, and the life, he is saying, among other things, that he is the way to love, the way we are supposed to love. And obviously, there isn't time to go into that way in any detail, but it does seem that there's one feature that's particularly relevant to family relationships, namely, that he loved his disciples and he prepared them to go forth on their own to preach the gospel, which simply means to spread the good news. He did this by teaching them. He taught them in a number of ways. He made frequent use of parables, which challenged his disciples to figure things out for themselves, and which in a subtle way conveyed the message that there is hidden meaning in all the ordinary events of everyday life. Think of the disciples after they had heard the parable of the sower. Would they ever see someone sowing seed in a field and not have that meaning come to mind? The world would look different to them. He taught by asking them questions. He taught by posing paradoxes, by saying impossible things, pluck your eye out and throw it away. And all these verbal modes of teaching depended on the profound impression made by his person, his personality, by the kind of individual he was. The disciples listened to him, took him with full seriousness, because they experienced him as a man who understood them with startling clarity and who genuinely cared about them, cared for them, wanted the best for them. And it all fits together, I think, under the premise that the essential nature of true power, of divine power, is to empower others. Theologically, this is a major factor in reconciling divine omnipotence with human freedom. These are mutually exclusive if the essential nature of power is to control. And all too often, this seems to be taken for granted on the scale of human relationships. But clearly, in the particular configuration of the Lord and the 12 disciples, the Lord was the one with power. And equally clearly, he was doing everything he could to empower the disciples, to share that power, to give that power to them, to open their minds, to stir their hearts. He didn't try to control their opinions with dogmatic teaching. He challenged them with stories and questions and paradoxes. He knew that his time on earth was limited. He led them lovingly from discipleship to apostleship. And if we take this way of loving as the standard against which our love of family members is evaluated, it works. Clearly, the task of parenting is very similar in the world of the newborn. Parents are effectively omnipotent. They have the power of life and death. And the newborn is, by comparison, helpless. With nourishment and care, the baby grows in size, strength, and competence. And the role of parents is to foster this process of empowerment with all the love and all the wisdom they can muster. And it takes both love and wisdom for parents to take seriously the fact that they didn't design this child. The Lord designs us all. It's the task of love and wisdom to discern that design as best we can. And clearly, too, as children become more capable of taking care of themselves, the role of the parents changes. There's a changing ratio between what is done for them and what is done by them, between their dependence and their independence. And again, I want to quote or refer to Robert Keegan's beautiful little summary of the truly nurturing environment, that it has to be able to do three things: to hold us when we need to be held, to let go of us when we need to get out there on our own, and to be there to come back to. And this, to me, represents three essential features of general love genuine love, the function of wisdom is to tell us when to do which. The floor is yours. Roy, at the back. Wait. Mike.
I was thinking about your mentioning about the family as a nuclear thing, but I thought of in the Acts where somebody, it would be the whole household of somebody, believed, or even the church, what was it, the household of faith, and that kind of a very communal aspect.
And there are more references to household than to family in the New Testament. And the household, the oikos, included servants. And you have the master of the household, the owner, actually, of slaves and so on. And in feudal times, it came to be, cuius regio, cuius religio, the baron's religion was automatically the religion of all subjects in the kingdom. The master's religion was the religion of all those in the household, by fiat, so to speak. And the oikos was in many ways an economic unit. So in that one of those quotes, I found it striking. I didn't want to. There is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields. as though fields are possessions, and so are all these other things. They're part of the economic unit.
Mm-hmm. There's even, I recall, if a man wishes to be a deacon or a bishop, they have to be the husband of one wife and be able to run his own household, let alone that of the church.
I want to go way back to the beginning of your lecture and pick one little bone with you about the abusive husband or wife. Mm-hmm. You mentioned it as coming from fear of abandonment, which I'm sure is an element in there, mm-hmm. but tying it a little bit closer to the fundamental motivations that Swedenborg gives us, the experience and training that I received indicates that the real underlying driving factor is the desire to control and dominate the other person, and that if that desire is present, it's the abuse. What we see externally as abuse will happen if that seems to be the most effective or the only way to be the controlling person in the relationship. And so you could even talk not just about abusive relationships, but about controlling relationships, because some spouses are able to control their spouse without the use of physical violence, but using psychological methods, and they can be just as effective, in fact, sometimes more effective, because they're more internal, whereas others end out using physical methods to do it. But the main point I wanted to make is that I do believe that the desire to dominate is probably a more fundamental factor in abusive relationships than the fear, which is a secondary characteristic I would put forward.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think if you're not afraid, then your desire to control, I think they're virtually inseparable. If you actually trust the other person, have no fear, then control is not necessary. And so much of the control is in fact exercised to prevent desertion. The wife is terrified of leaving and stays because leaving may result in her death. I doubt that they're that separable. But primary thing is that I see the desire to control as coming essentially from a sense of immense weakness.
I agree about the leaving being very dangerous. That is probably the most dangerous thing, and that's by design.
Yeah.
What I'm pushing against is the common view of many programs about abusive spouses that either follow a fear, you know, overcoming fear-based model or an anger management model, you know, that you have to be able to control your anger. And I've adopted a view that says people do things for reasons. They have particular motivations in doing things. And I also have come to believe, yes, that the two are inseparable, that evil and fear are inseparable. In hell, fear is the only thing that restrains the evil, and it is inseparably tied to the evil, because anyone committing an evil automatically rejects the Lord's protection and opens him or herself up to the punishment meted out by fellow evil spirits. And so I agree that the two are inseparable. But I would say, looking at the fundamentals of what drives us as human beings, we're presented with four basic motivations: love of God, love of the neighbor, love of the world, and love of self. And I take it as, I guess, axiomatic that in any given act, we're acting from one or more of those. And I don't want to say that anyone who's abusing his or her partner is on the road to hell internally, because we can't make that judgment. But where do actions of violence against another person come from? Ultimately, they're going to come from either a desire to control or a desire to possess, to have possessions. That's love of self and love of the world. And so I'm explicitly pushing against the fear-centered model toward a love or motivation-centered model. In this case, love of self, love of dominion from love of self, which I think is probably the most common in abusive relationships.
I'd just like to say in response to that, Lee, just that it makes me think of the fact that although you're kind of framing it as coming from actually inside the person as a motivation, I think that in some ways I look at it more as a resulting in the fear and the response to what's happening between the person who is being abusive and the outside world and what's happened to them in the past, and then trying to seek more control over their own life within their own home. And I think that's sort of where the motivation also is coming from. It's not just about pure love of self, but it's I think in a lot of ways responsive to the way the rest of life is affecting them, and then trying to control that within their own household and within their own marriage relationship.
And I was just going to say that I don't think that a lot of abuse is necessarily spontaneous, but I think it's learned. It's a pattern that is being repeated by the individual that they learn from, unfortunately, most likely their parents. And it's almost an involuntary thing that drives people to do this. It's not a spontaneous desire for control, but it's a pattern. And I know that there are studies that show that a lot of abusers were themselves abused.
In a sense, it has helped me to think of, we learn behavioral languages as we grow up. We learn that this kind of behavior communicates this message and it's understood in this way. And in some families, respect is gained only through the exertion of force. And anything less than that is perceived as interpreted as weakness. And you learn this language. And so whereas I would be looking for respect by behaving in following one pattern, someone else would look for the same kind of respect in a very different way. And when you get people from speaking conflicting languages, so to speak, you get vicious problems.
I remember a mother once accused me of being abusive, and I was aghast. I'm a little what we in our family call Dutchy. That might be, you know, a little pushy. And it kind of turned out, I said, well, does that mean then that when I disagree with you? And she says, yes, and we both had to laugh. So maybe the real abusive stuff is, you know, we have to call it by the right name, I guess. And not everything is abusive if somebody disagrees or goes against us.
Oh, I disagree.
You disagree. Okay.
On a whole different topic, we Swedenborgians tend to look at the Gospels and some at the Book of Revelation when we look at the New Testament, mm-hmm. but at least the rest of the Protestant world, and I would say the rest of the Christian world, looks heavily to Paul mm-hmm. and his writings. And I would say that's where a lot of statements about family and the proper relationships and roles and that sort of thing of the different members of the family are spoken of more mm-hmm. than in the gospel. Yeah. And I suppose that if we were to look at evangelical Christians' views on the family and family values, we'd have to broaden the search into their scriptures, namely to look all through Paul and mm-hmm. see what they're getting there and how they're reading it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does strike me, I certainly should have, but it does strike me that in the rhetoric about family values, Scripture is very rarely cited.
Except when it says the man is the head of the family. They
yeah,
love
that,
to quote
that,
Scripture
that one
on
in
that
Ephesians,
one.
Yeah, that in Ephesians 5, yeah.
I found it very interesting. It seemed to me that the main topic of your lecture is that we have to learn how to love.
Yeah.
Which is such an unfamiliar concept to me because I was raised in a household so full of love. I mean, I'm sure I learned it originally, but it's not something I remember learning how to do. It's just something that I do.
Yeah.
But I do think it is something that as people we forget. We get into like, this is how I should treat you or this is how what I should do. And you forget that if you just love the person, you'll make a mistake quite possibly, but you will know how to act correctly and you'll know what you should be doing if you just focus on just pure loving mm-hmm. and not the selfish love, a love of them. And so
yeah,
I think that's the most important part that sometimes kind of falls by the wayside when we get all caught up in the actual doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then, you know, people who are raised in other under other models of love will also take that in without realizing it and assume that that's the way everybody else is.
I actually had another comment on that about there are definitely reasons and answers as to why people become abusive, and we can't make excuses for it because I've watched a couple of families that I know multiple generations of, and if you go two or three generations back, there's a lot of abuse, but each generation the next generation realized that that was the wrong thing and worked to get better. And the first generation
yeah.
of the very bad abusers were slightly abusive, but they weren't as bad. And the next generation didn't abuse but had a bad temper, and the following generation doesn't even have a temper. So like,
yeah.
you can't make an excuse because it is a choice. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, yeah, and basically, I get very, what do I say, nervous around, not around generalizations, say about, quote, the abusive family, but about the transfer of generalizations to individual cases. You know, no two marriages are identical. No two brides, no two grooms are identical. And you can make generalizations about marriages. The divorce rate is going down. The people are marrying later. That doesn't predict what any particular couple is going to do. And it does help, though, to understand that if someone has been raised in an abusive family, that is a clue to understanding how they behave and how they react. Yes, they are free, and you can probably help them make their choices much better if you understand what lies behind their present behavior and language.
That is, if they know that they have a choice. If they know that they have a choice,
yeah.
Oftentimes people,
yeah,
because
yeah.
they're raised a certain way, don't necessarily understand that they have the choice to make,
yeah.
to choose yeah. better, more loving behavior, or what more loving behavior can be.
Yeah.
And there's also the factor of mental illness in some of these cases as well,
yeah.
or without recognition for that.
And that's in a sense, that's just what I'm saying, that if, as you begin to understand how this person views things, and I think just about everybody except real obsessive compulsions feels, I'm making some choices. But the range of choices they perceive may be very limited, is limited by the way they have been trained to see things. And if we can begin to see through their eyes, then we have a much better chance of saying, look, no, there are some other alternatives here that you haven't seen. You do have a wider range of freedom. We can open doors, so to speak.
And I think that's very important, that mm-hmm. we don't necessarily start our adult lives with a full portfolio of options available to us. I mean, we're taught right and wrong by our parents, and different sets of parents teach a different, you know, can be a very different sort of portfolio of rights and wrongs.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of children of abusive families, they've got a pretty distorted perspective on what right and wrong is, and they don't it isn't necessarily a very healthy stepping off point for, you know, their first intimate relationship.
Yeah. But and talking to people who have been raised like that in our language is a little bit like speaking English to someone to whom it isn't their own language. It's very hard for them to translate, to understand what you're saying.
And we don't just know what right and wrong is,
yeah.
I think. You have to learn it. You have to be taught it. I mean, we hear that all the time.
Yeah.
It's the parents' first responsibility to teach children right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. And parents, in one sense, can't help doing it simply by the way they behave, by what they approve of and what they reject.
And I was just thinking about what Emily said, and you know what love is. We all know what love is, but I think we all have a different definition for what love is. In other words, we here today believe we know what love is, but I bet no two of us would describe it in exactly the same way. And love in a healthy family is very different from love in an abusive family, and how it manifests itself and how it's defined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we have reached, nobody's keeping time, but I think the official clock says we should adjourn.